Unsolved Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, editor of PrescientSciFi.com, and finally, we get our first real quality science fiction movie of the year. It only took until November. It is Arrival, which premiered about a week ago. I saw it the second day, and different kind of science fiction movie from what we've seen so far this year. We've seen just a lot of basically sci-fi fantasy, mostly fantasy, superhero movies, and some really cheesy, just, you know, insulting ones like Independence Day Resurgence. This is the first real heady sci-fi movie that really, that was in theaters, that really hit an impact on me. It's a definitely more, you know, different kind of movie, not for everyone, but I wanted to get into it, talk a little bit about it, and also talk about what's going on with TV. I just started watching Stranger Things. Yeah, I know, I'm like, yeah, 2 months, 2 or 3 months behind the curve in terms of Stranger Things. Everyone has seen it already except me. I've only seen about 5 episodes of it, so I got a little bit to go before I finish, but I want to talk about that. Talk a little bit about just a few other things on TV, because really that's where all the science fiction, the best science fiction is these days. It's on TV, not really in theaters, but Arrival is the exception, so far at least, for this calendar year 2016. So let's get into it and talk about this very, very clever movie. All right, for my first impressions of Arrival after walking out of the theater, first of all, I'm going to talk about this, as with every other movie review, I'm going to talk about this movie to you with the assumption that you have already seen it, or that you are going to see it, but you don't care about spoilers. You want to know what you're getting into. So there will be spoilers. I will be talking about the movie in detail, so that disclaimer is out there. So anyway, back to first impressions. First is, like, this is much more of an emotional movie, more a kind of human drama than the science fiction we've been treated to most of this year. It had a lot to do with the main character, Amy Adams, or Dr. Banks, about her personal story and her struggles, and to a lesser extent, a little bit of Jeremy Renner's as well. So, his character. The plot actually does not, you know, most superhero movies follow the typical hero's journey plot. Most, you know, these Independence Day, I mean, they're just action movies. It's a very straightforward plot, you know, three-act system. The structure of here is a little bit different. It's very clever because it's not very predictable. It kind of moves in its own way. I kind of have a hard time explaining it, but basically you don't really know where you are in the movie at any given time. So I kind of appreciate that. I like movies that are not very predictable, where they've grabbed you and sucked you in, but you don't know really where you are in the story. You don't know if you're this is like the right before the climax, if this is the introduction of the characters, this is just the first battle, or wait, this is going to be the key to the end of the movie, or this is going to come in, like, you can't, like, as you're watching, as I watch movies, I sometimes start putting these things together in my head, which, you know, if I said them out loud, I would ruin the movie for other people. I'd be one of those annoying moviegoers. But most of the time I go to movies by myself, or if I do go with other people, I don't say a word. So, but it's in my head. I'm thinking it. But this particular movie, I couldn't put it all together in my head. I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen and what was going on until the very end. Maybe some people figured it out before me. I'm sure there's some very, very clever people that saw this movie that might have put it all together, but I did not. I appreciated that. I also appreciated that it was not overly reliant on visuals. I think that's refreshing. Virtually every movie, science fiction movie, relies and depends on great visuals, great special effects, great weird aliens, explosions, flashing lights, and you know, very sexy, good-looking actors or whatever. This movie doesn't do that. So there are some pretty cool visuals here and there, but it definitely does not lean on that too heavily. The aliens, in particular, they did not follow the normal path of humanoid or insect-like aliens, which basically covers 90% of all aliens in movies. They went with these kind of squid-looking things called heptapods that appear to live in kind of a very humid, dense, kind of foggy atmosphere. They don't breathe oxygen, and they just look like giant squids, basically. So that I thought that was a little unusual. I kind of appreciated that as well, because I think it's basically we have to get over the fact that whatever intelligent species of extraterrestrial life we face, the odds of it being humanoid are, I mean, that's far from likely. I mean, it's possible, but I mean, most species on this planet are not humanoid. Basically, there's only two or three species that really resemble us in any way. The rest of them are either, you know, for example, almost all of them are quadruped. You know, some of them fly, some of them are water. Anyway, point is, kind of a, I like the alien. It was a good start. And the story itself was more about, I mean, it was about first contact to some extent, and it was a very intelligent, clever look at contact, you know, focusing exclusively on the exchange of language. Most people would probably, I think the broader audience probably found it pretty boring. I found it fascinating. But it's kind of, it looks at a very, very important step in alien in first contact that usually we try to skip over. Basically, the aliens already know our language, or their language, you know, we have subtitles, or we're able to figure it out really fast, or whatever. I mean, they always kind of find a way around that. This one, I mean, the whole movie is about trying to find a way to communicate with these aliens who are very patient. And so those were my first impressions. It was a smart movie. It was, you know, not common. It was not predictable. It was pretty emotional, more about the psychology of the main actor, and, you know, kind of an unusual movie. And I think I appreciated every part of it, and I liked kind of it being, forcing you to think, forcing you to pay attention to what was being said. I mean, I liked all that. The cast is pretty high profile. Amy Adams is one of the biggest stars. Jeremy Renner is definitely one of the biggest stars out there. Forrest Whitaker, everyone knows him. The director was Denis Villeneuve, or however you want to say his name. I think it's Villeneuve. His only like really big credit was the movie Sicario, which was that drug cartel movie with Emily Blunt. But he is doing the next Blade Runner movie. So he is definitely connected, and definitely has a, and this movie was pretty strong too. I mean, great cast and some pretty serious backing. So this is a guy, this is a director on the rise, it seems. The writer of this screenplay was Eric Heisserer. He's done mostly horror, including the remake of The Thing, which was kind of strange. This doesn't, based on the previous things he's written, this didn't really fit. So I'm not so sure how much of his original screenplay is really in this movie. It's kind of hard to believe that this was his vision, but I could be wrong. Maybe this guy is, he wanted to do more than horror. Maybe he is more than a horror writer, but, so he's the writer of the screenplay, but the whole idea is based on the short story by Ted Chiang. The name of the short story is Story of Your Life. Won a bunch of awards about, I don't know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Ted Chiang is a pretty high-profile science fiction writer in the kind of in certain circles. Basically, he's one of those guys that they love to give awards to for his short stories. I mean, it's kind of the literary community just adores him, and so he gets nominated. I mean, there's like a core of authors and writers in the science fiction fantasy community that get nominated for these awards every other year. It's kind of like a closely knit little clique they got. And he's just one of them, you know, and he's a very smart writer. He does more of like, more of what mainstream literary writers do, instead of just giving you just a bunch of science fiction, you know, aliens, technology, and action. He tries to be a little bit more thoughtful about it, more thought-provoking. And I have personally not read any of his stuff yet. He's on my to-read list now, after this movie. I'm curious to read Story of Your Life and see how it fits the movie, and to see what, you know, because it left a positive impression on me, so I'm actually curious about his work. Most people may not be. This movie, you know, this kind of writing can come off as what's the word, just aloof, I guess. Like, he's writing to a very exclusive audience who quote unquote get him. Very smart, thoughtful. Those aren't the right words. But I mean, like the way he writes, you know, the things he does in his stories that are very clever, the kind of things that only, you know, the real literary, you know, experts and, you know, the intelligentsia would appreciate, you know, kind of tricks with grammar, tricks with spelling, and, you know, plot symmetry and some of these other things that if you're really a hardcore writer or English professor or you have a master's or whatever, you would appreciate them. But most people in the general, even if you're educated, you know, unless you have a really strong background in English and composition, you wouldn't really appreciate these things because they're just not all that interesting to you. And they're just not all that amazing and wowing. But if you're like into this stuff, like some people are, I guess the way he writes is like, just like, wow, what a genius. All right. Into the core of the movie. The movie is about language, of course. Basically, Amy Adams is there to find a way to communicate with the aliens because they don't, the way they speak, I mean, nobody can really figure out if they're saying anything, what their language is. It sounds like moans or guttural growls or things like that. So they can't figure out what any of it is. So it's about language, and their particular language is written, what they say and what they write, and they have this way of writing visually to show they're out, and, you know, they don't really have an alphabet, but the way they kind of do symbols and everything, it looks like a drawn circles. They literally look like they're drawing circles, using ink from their pouches, I suppose. But that's what the movie's about, and about the importance of language in not only just communicating intent, identity, action, plans. It's really about that what language is, how important it is to civilization. Amy Adams kind of, in one of her books, it's kind of cited in the movie that language is the cornerstone of civilization, and Jeremy Renner's character disagrees, thinking it's science, but really science does not exist without language. And by language, I mean verbal and written, both. So it's not just about communicating with these aliens. I mean, just going through this process, the movie's kind of showing you how important language is to us, just to the human race, and how important it is, you know, just between different nations and races and ethnic groups on Earth, how important language is to all of us and what it means for us and what it kind of means in terms of the way we think. And it leads to one particularly interesting hypothesis on language. It's called the linguistic relativity hypothesis. Now, I'm just going to read a little bit out of the Wikipedia page about linguistic relativity. Because I'm not an expert in this, I don't pretend to be. So I'm just going to read straight out of a free encyclopedia, but just to give you an idea. So here's what it says. Linguistic relativity is a concept paradigm in linguistics and cognitive science that holds that the structure of a language affects its speaker's cognition or worldview. It used to have... All right, I'll skip over that. Da, 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 da. So basically, the hypothesis believes that our language, the words we use, the way we communicate influences philosophy, neurobiology, you know, all these other ways of thinking we have about... So at one point it mentions in the movie, like, it's just not one thing to say things. Do you think in language? Do you think, you know, in your mind, are you thinking of words? Are you thinking of the sounds? Like, is that how you're analyzing data, collecting data? Is that how you're feeling things? Is that how you see the world? And so the question is, well, if somebody speaks Mandarin, do they see and perceive the world differently than someone who speaks English, just from the simple fact that they speak different languages and therefore think in different languages? And so that comes into, you know, whether it's a phonetic alphabet or a symbolic alphabet, you know, the difference between Japanese and Mandarin alphabets versus ours, the way they structure sentences, you know, things like that. Does that influence the way they think? And the hypothesis says yes. And it says it's not deterministic. It doesn't, like, dominate. You know, language doesn't control, language doesn't completely control things where, you know, if you speak English, you're going to think a certain way. But it is influential, and it's probably more about, not really about English versus French or Spanish, it's more like, you know, Latin languages versus Germanic or Scandinavian or Mandarin, Hindi, African, Native American. I mean, that's usually what they're looking at when they study this hypothesis. They're not looking at Spanish versus English. I mean, the languages are too similar from a broader spectrum perspective. They're looking at, like, Hopi or Pueblo Indian languages versus English. And so in the movie, the way we speak and think is not doesn't really come into play. It's really more about the heptapod language, and the way their language works is that it gives you a very unique perspective, a non-linear perspective. So they don't really distinguish between past, present, and future in the way we do. And the way they write their the way they write their circles and everything, there's a connection between everything they say. And so when they communicate, they're communicating, you know, their broader thoughts are broader. They're telling you everything, you know, the past, present, and future in the same sentence. And just learning the language, mastering it, and thinking in it gives you insight into the future. And that's kind of what happens to Amy Adams, because she becomes the most, immersed in the language. So she starts to have dreams. And throughout the movie, and this is the big reveal, of course. Throughout the movie, we think she's having flashbacks, you know, these dreams. She's having flashbacks of her life before the aliens showed up in their giant ships. And really, they're not dreams at all. They're actually visions of the future. And so in the dreams, it shows her with her daughter, you know, growing up and then dying of some rare disease. And we come to find out that she never had a daughter before the aliens arrived. All those were dreams. She didn't have a daughter. She doesn't have a daughter until after she learns their language. So that was a neat little thing, trick that they did with the plot. But anyway, but the point being is that she was dreaming and she was starting to see things that had not happened yet, just by learning their language. So the hypothesis kind of shows that kind of temporal difference of being able to see things in a non-linear way. Once you learn their language, you get to think the way they think, and they don't think in a non-linear way. They can see the future, and they kind of give it to her. So it's basically taken the hypothesis, and the hypothesis that we have is not really that language can do that, but, you know, this is fiction. So they had to kick it up a notch. So instead of, you know, seeing the world a little differently because you learn a different language, you learn an alien language, you get to see the future. All right, so some of you, and I thought this too, are probably out there thinking, all right, that's really far-fetched. That's a little fantasy. That's over the top. That's silly. You learn an alien language and all of a sudden you can see the future? Come on. So, and I kind of agree that, I mean, it's taking a scientific hypothesis and stretching it so that it makes the story more interesting. And I'm not so sure that Ted Chiang's original story actually does that. I don't know if she sees the future with such clarity as she does in the movie. But I mean, it's a fair kind of criticism, and I'll get maybe into a little bit later. But the movie also had kind of the more traditional alien first contact kind of elements to it. The first thoughts are about security, of course, so the military comes in, evacuates the area where these ships have landed, and the military gets around preparing for a strike in case the aliens turn out to be hostile. Obviously, they want to communicate first and learn why the aliens are there. What is their intent? You know, why are you here? And then, of course, you know, some basic straightforward questions. You know, in movies where we see a bunch of ships, you know, fly over, you know, our capitals, you know, they usually blow up our capitals, or they come out and talk to us and say, we come in peace, or they land on the White House lawn. This one was different in that there are 12 ships and they go to random locations. The one in America or North America lands in some remote part of Montana. They mention that one lands in Venezuela, one lands in the China Sea, one lands in the middle of nowhere in Russia, one in Sudan, one in the Black Sea. So they tell you, like, look, we've analyzed their locations and we cannot find any pattern. These are not the 12 strongest countries on Earth, you know, Venezuela, Sudan, and some of these other places. So it's not about that. They're not near cities. And some are over land, some are over water. So it's kind of, I mean, that was kind of a cool little slight tick difference on first contact. So it's they have some of that as well for people. But I think the overall kind of focus on language and then, of course, the ending really moves away from that. But there is kind of a more common mechanism. And I think one of the reviewers I read about this compared it to the movie and the movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Okay, so in The Day the Earth Stood Still, you have like the politicians and the leaders all, and the soldiers, you know, kind of shoot at Klondathu or the automaton because out of fear. You know, they feel they're being invaded, they're a threat, and just out of, you know, since they don't know, they fear what they don't know, they fire, and they treat him as an invader. Whereas the scientists and doctors can't wait to talk to him, and they're the heroes. They're the ones that avoid war and kind of demonstrate that, you know, the rest of us, you know, most of us are stupid, only a few of us are smart. And in this one, it's kind of the same thing. The government and the military, they're patient, actually. They're more patient in this movie than they are in the day the Earth stood still, but they still kind of are afraid of these aliens, and they want, and actually a few soldiers take it upon themselves to try to blow up the alien ship, and of course they fail, but their kind of action, the aliens almost expect it, you know, they react. Let me back up. This all came about because they translated the question, why are you here? The aliens answered, offer weapon. And as soon as that happened, the U.S. government's like, all right, we're going to stop cooperating with everyone else, and we're going to try and secure this weapon and figure out what the hell it is. That was their reaction. So all the cooperation and the scientific endeavor and the patience ended. But the 12 ships really weren't bringing that. They were bringing language, you know, bringing peace, the ability to see the future. So weapon was mistranslated, and that's what Amy Adams was trying to explain to them. Say, look, weapon is the word that we think means what we think to mean weapon, but it might be mistranslated. The difference between a weapon and a tool is very, you know, it's depending on its intent. So we might have mistranslated, we might have missed this part of their language, we're still trying to figure it out. So they might not mean weapon the way we mean it. They might be meaning tool, because, you know, a hammer can be a tool if you're using it to hammer nails. Or it might be a weapon if you start slamming someone over to the head with it. So the way they get around this, and one of the weird things the aliens do is they give each 12 locations one piece of the language, so that they all have to share to put the whole language together. But of course, you know, things, the bomb and the guns happen, and so Amy Adams gets the whole language, because they realize that they're kind of divide by 12 and forcing humanity to unify and work together. That plan didn't work. So they're like, all right, well, we trust the Dr. Banks, Amy Adams. We're just going to give her the whole language. And so that's what happened there. But obviously their first thought was to force us to work together by giving each 12, you know, the 12 people involved, a different piece of the puzzle. The thing I thought was very cool, and a lot of people probably won't really appreciate this because it's not a traditional movie thing, is they mention that her daughter's name will be Hannah, which is a palindrome. It is spelled the same way forward as it is backwards, and if you actually watch the movie and think about it, the movie is similar forwards as it is backwards. The end of the movie basically ends with her meeting her husband and deciding to have a child. That's the beginning of the movie too. And the end of the movie shows, you know, a lot of that child, the growth, the upbringing, and then her passing away, her, you know, losing her husband, whatever. Well, a lot of that's shown in the beginning of the movie, and then the middle of the movie is the alien contact. And so, really, the movie kind of works the same way in both directions. And that was kind of the point about time being non-linear. I mean, the movie's plot is, in some ways, non-linear, but it is kind of a cheap trick, because the beginning parts of the movie are, none of it happened. They're just showing it to you to create this symmetry. She doesn't have dreams about this daughter of hers until after she starts learning the heptapod language in the middle of the movie. So at the beginning of the movie, we're just being shown things that she, I mean, are we, I guess maybe we're led to believe that she's already having dreams about a daughter in the future before she learns the heptapod language? I don't know. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think the first part of the movie is showing things that haven't happened yet. And her voiceover, her narration, is kind of like her telling the story of Hannah. And the story, she says, the story actually began when I first was contacted and brought into Montana to learn about the heptapods. Well, if that's the case, then why did you show us her whole life, you know, in the first 20 minutes of the movie? to create a weird symmetry. So, I mean, it's they kind of created their own symmetry by basically giving you a bunch of scenes of things that hadn't happened yet and that the main character's not even aware of until she starts dreaming about it later on. So, I don't know. It was clever, but it's artificial. It's kind of put in there on purpose. But as a viewer, and I think the reason it works is because as a viewer, you believe that she had a daughter, she had a husband, and that it was all, she lost it all, and that's why she's kind of this introverted loner professor at this university, you know, at the time the aliens arrive. So they make you believe that all that already happened, and that's why she's already kind of a little quiet, antisocial, introspective, and not doesn't really give a shit about credit. You know, she's more just obsessed with her work, nothing else, you know, because she doesn't seem to have a personal life. You know, her mother calls her and she keeps having to reassure her mother she's okay. So everything's there to make you believe that this already happened. And that's why, you know, Dr. Banks is the way she is. When in fact, none of that was true. That's just the way she is. She never was married and never had a daughter. That all happens afterwards. So for the audience member, you know, it's a cool little thing. And it kind of gives you, but it's all false, you know, so maybe it's not that cool. It's more of like a misleading, false thing, but they do that to kind of fit their non-linear storyline kind of idea. And I think that probably has a lot to do with the source material of Ted Chiang. I haven't read the story yet, but I have a feeling that's exactly how his short story reads. And they wanted to bring that. So, but anyway, I've already kind of touched on my two criticisms here. The language, the mastery of a language leads you to the ability to see the future. I mean, that's a stretch. And I think some people will kind of maybe roll their eyes at that. So, but I mean, science fiction does that. They do that all the time when they stretch science to get a more dramatic outcome. Happens all the time. So why should we hold Arrival accountable to that and not hold any of these other movies accountable to the way they stretch science to the limit? The first 10 minutes being the first 10 to 15 minutes are of backstory, which is not really backstory. It's misleading and it's kind of a, you know, none of it happened. And then you find out later it all happens in the future. I think some people may just find that annoying and unnecessarily confusing and won't be too impressed with it. Like I said, maybe, you know, literary types and maybe even movie buffs and a lot of critics, you know, love that kind of thing. But maybe some of the audience may not like that. It didn't bother me, but the language, you know, being able to see the future with language kind of was like, to me, that kind of made me shake my head a little bit. But the kind of the first 10 minutes of the movie being used to create some symmetry, that didn't bother me, but it might bother other people. But anyway, that's my assessment of Arrival. I think it is so far the best science fiction movie of the year, but this has not been a good year for science fiction. We've got a lot of crap this year, a lot of Hollywood explosions and, you know, fantasy trying to pretend it's science fiction. And so, and a lot of DC Comics really just gave us two big piles of crap with Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad. I mean, they're entertaining, I guess, to some extent, but I mean, neither of those movies really. So, and we haven't had any like hardcore science. We haven't really had any kind of like hard science fiction up until now. Now we're gonna get another one in the movie Passengers, I believe, with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. So I think that might be more of a traditional hard science fiction movie. Rogue One is a Star Wars movie, which, you know, kind of is much closer to the fantasy line than it is to hard science fiction. Those are the two high profile movies at the end of this year. I think there might be two other kind of low budget ones, but really, it's looking like Star Wars and Passengers are going to have to really save this year in terms of sci-fi movies. This has not really been a good year. Last year was awesome. This year, kind of a down year so far. And Arrival is a good movie, and it stands head and shoulders above the others, but that's just not saying a whole lot. And I really can't say it was a great, awesome, you know, blow-you-away, really thought-provoking movie. It is thought-provoking, it is smart, it is kind of a pretty well-done movie, but, you know, there's a few things that bothered me a little bit, and so, yeah, you know, it's just, it may not leave an impact on a lot of people. And so far, let's see, it's been a week, but anyway, its opening weekend was $24 million, which is a pretty meh kind of opening. It did get awesome reviews. The critics love it. Like I said, like the people that are really, you know, snobby and the critics and the people that are really into movies, they generally like the kind of things that are in Arrival. So they gave it like a 93% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. The fans like it too so far. It's got 82% approval and about an average 4.1 rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So far it's getting good ratings. It hasn't made a lot of money yet, but it didn't really cost that much money to make. I think it only had a $47 million price tag. So it'll probably be a profitable, successful movie, but it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be up in the range of like The Martian, or definitely not Marvel or DC. You know, this might make maybe $200 million when it's all said and done at the most. And, you know, nowadays $200 million just isn't that impressive. But anyway, that is my take on Arrival. Okay, let's switch to TV. First of all, that's where the great science fiction is. That's where the great entertainment is these days. There's been a couple cool movies this year, but really, I mean, TV is where it's at. And about a week ago, I started Stranger Things, a Netflix original. It premiered about 2 or 3 months ago, so I'm behind the times, I know. But so far, I've enjoyed it quite a bit. It takes place in 1983 in Hawkins, Indiana. So first of all, it has a really weird setting. I mean, why 1983 and why some small town in Indiana that happens to be the location of a national laboratory that does advanced research into weaponry and things like that. But, you know, they put it there. But a lot of it is about the town itself and the people itself. And they go into amazing detail. I mean, the costumes, the apparel they all wear all look like they come from 1983 or the late 70s. The way they speak, it's hard to tell really, because I wasn't around in 1980. I was only a few months old in 1983. But the way they talk and the way they seem to not carry a lot of the slang and a lot of the patterns of the way we speak now. So I think they made some attempt to make it sound like these people are from 1983. And they really have a really impressive cast of child actors. They're doing a tremendous job. It's really well written. I mean, this is more than just, you know, a fantasy, science fiction, horror kind of story, which is, you know, if you see the previews and everything, that's what it is. It really is well written. There's like a very rich detail into, you know, the experience of these young boys, you know, being into, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and being teased. And then there's the teenage girl is in love with the most popular guy in school, and she has kind of this experience of you know, losing her virginity and really just being, you know, her first love and everything. And you have a police chief who lost his daughter and is alcoholic and kind of in a self-destructive path, but he's the chief of police. He's actually pretty good at his job. You have a lot of hardworking folks around here that are putting in a lot of hours, and they live in these dumpy, you know, Midwestern houses, you know, that look, I mean, today they look like they're all in poverty, but in reality, that's just the houses and the things you see there is actually not all that different from the way most people lived in the Midwest in the 80s. It wasn't, I mean, the economy was coming out of, in 82 and 83, the economy was really growing and coming out of it. But I mean, that kind of prosperity probably didn't reach Hawkins, Indiana by 1983. So you're kind of looking at a town that's probably still living in the kind of down years of the 70s and kind of the tough times. So really, to us, it looks like a little bit depressing. But for them, like that's been their life. That's been their experience for most of probably the last 10 years of the 70s and into the early 80s. So the setting is very well, the detail of it, the thoughts of it, the music, the intro music and the intro kind of, they go through, you know, the cast and everything at the beginning of the show. I mean, it's all really cool. It all feels like it's from 1983. And the acting, I mean, it's just tremendous. I mean, it's really, they did a tremendous job on that, I thought. And Winona Ryder really does a great job as a frantic mother. I mean, really, just one example of the acting. I mean, that she really sells that very well. And the police chief, I mean, all of them, they do a tremendous job of acting and performing the settings. All right, so all the pieces are there for a great show. So what about the story itself? Well, the story is about two things that escape from this Hawkins lab into the town of Hawkins, you know, which is adjacent. So one of them is a girl with a shaved head who's been experimented on and clearly has superpowers. So that part I feel like I've seen that before. And also it's kind of like we need to hide her. The kids need to hide her from their parents, otherwise the parents would call the police. And she's a girl who can barely talk, is not very well suited because she's been living in a lab her whole life and just been around scientists, so she doesn't know how to relate to people very well. All of this kind of feels like I've seen it before, but it's still very well done. But then there's this other thing that also escaped from the lab, kind of this faceless monster thing that can kidnap people and bring them to some alternate dimension. I mean, it feels like it's from Doom or something. I mean, it's just so these two really extraordinary, spectacular things escape from the lab and are now in this town, and this laboratory is just doing a god. The government's just doing a god awful job covering this up. I mean, just terrible. I mean, there's two kids missing, and you also like this one girl escaped, and now these kids. If this girl's ever discovered, everyone's gonna know. So it's anyway. So I'm five episodes in. I haven't seen the whole thing yet, so I don't know how the first season ends. But at least as far as I'm concerned, though, I think. I mean, I'm not into horror that much, and this whole kind of, monster that can drag you into another dimension and then you can communicate with the people in the real dimension through lights. I mean, it's just, and the things that kind of just are trying to come through the walls. I don't know. That to me screams of cheap horror. The girl is very interesting because of the history of CIA experimentation on children with remote viewing and telekinesis and things like that. I mean, so that has a basis in conspiracy theories and a little bit of science behind it. You can almost see that happening with them, finding orphans or taking children from drug addicts or people like that. Kind of like what happened in the movie Minority Report. So, that has more behind it. The kind of weird monstery, like kind of fleshy, black, bloody thing that's in the wall of this lab, and you can go inside of it. I mean, I'm at episode five, so maybe they explain it a little better and kind of put some detail behind that. But right now, that just looks like, all right, you're making a horror show with a pretty just weak, cheap villain or monster, monster show. And to me, like, if that's the case, if that's where the show is going, I mean, they're wasting a lot of really great stuff here. A lot of great acting, a lot of great sets, a lot of great just little sub stories going on. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff going on here. If they're just going to turn this into a little monster thing, I mean, to me that's wasted. So I really hope there's a little bit more to this faceless monster than has been shown so far. And I really hope that this isn't just going to be something where this laboratory just keeps spitting out one supernatural thing after another, and that's how they're going to build the show. I'm really hoping that that's not where this goes. But I got three episodes to go, so I might be just jumping the gun a little bit here, and maybe I don't need to be worried about those things. But anyway, that's Stranger Things. When I'm done, I can tell you whether I recommend it or not. As of now, I think I am. I think it's a very cool show. I mean, it's got a lot going for it, and a lot of people love it. So it does have a lot going for it. It's just that like I said, I have a little concern that it's just going to be a monster show. Well, on Westworld, we got a couple big reveals. Some people that we thought were humans are actually robots, and the robots are showing a lot more self-awareness as time goes on. We all knew that was coming. Anyone who saw the Westworld movie and just knows about AI robot movies in general knew this was coming. The whole question was, well, why? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Why are they becoming self-aware? And who's going to stop them? And who should we care about? Who is, if they all die, like, is any of us going to be upset? And the show is moving very slowly in that direction, and we're starting to care more and more about some of these characters, and we're starting to see a little bit more of the bigger picture of what happened to Dr. Ford and Arnold, and also who this do how sinister this Dr. Ford is. The one character I want to talk about real quick that I was real irritated with is this woman who represents the board. I mean, she is. I don't know if this is maybe somebody's going to call her out on this on the show, but she is basically every cliche there is when it comes to being a corporate operative. I mean, she first of all, she walks into the park not telling anyone who she is. She's young and beautiful, some hot shot, you know, protege of the board, I'm assuming, chairman of the board, maybe even the chairman of the board's daughter, you know, something like that. And how does she meet one of her first meetings? First of all, she has really dark intentions and it's a power play and she's there to screw over Dr. Ford or to come in and change the park. You know, she's the one that's going to make it happen. She wields all the power from this mysterious board. So she has to come in and look like a badass and intimidate, you know, management. You know, that's what she's there for. So what does she do? She invites the other female executive of quality assurance up there and answers the door naked after having sex with one of the hosts. And of course, you can see the host tied to the bed. And she even asks to bum a cigarette after sex. I mean, this is all stuff you see like in late night shows, you know, after great sex, you have a cigarette and then she leans, you know, she kind of lays back and leans on the side of the couch like she's too cool to sit upright. And then she does all this kind of posturing and veiled threats in her language. And then she basically says, well, I don't really like you as a person, but I like you for this job. You know, all this kind of posturing BS. I mean, it was all just so transparent. And maybe she'll be called out on that. Maybe that's what the show was trying to do, is make her a little over the top. So that way later on, somebody kind of says, oh, come on, you know, what the hell is this? But anyway, if they're not, I mean, I just thought it was ridiculous. And some of the, it kind of fits with my overall problem with some of this management versus the board BS. I mean, there's all this like cynicism and they swear at the weirdest times at each other. And they're all kind of like leery and suspicious of each other. But like after watching a lot of that, I'm like, why should I care? This is a fucking amusement park. I don't care if the board and management get along. You know, and all this posturing, like the only thing at stake are people's jobs and money. Well, I don't care. I mean, nobody cares about these people. I mean, I kind of care about Bernard. That's about it. The rest of them, I mean, they're awful people. So what do I care if they're fired? So, and it just doesn't fit with the whole what is human and what is human nature and AI self. I mean, it's an entirely different side plot, but I think it's crap. And that character they introduced from the, you know, this representative of the board or corporate, I don't know. I thought it was dumb, but maybe they're planning to kind of turn that on its head. So I don't know. I do still love Westworld. It's very interesting. It's very thought provoking. That particular subplot I think is just, I don't care for it at all. I like the other stuff. I like the stuff that happens in the park. I like Maeve's, you know, rise to consciousness and intelligence and stuff like that. And also the Man in Black, Ed Harris. I mean, that stuff's cool and interesting. The whole board versus management thing, just, I don't care. All right, this is about the end, but I wanted to talk a little bit before I sign off about some things that I'm going to be changing here with Thought Crime and Prescient Sci-Fi. When I started off with Prescient and with Thought Crime, I wanted to kind of promote independent science fiction novels and books and stories. Stuff that comes from either self-published authors or from small presses or from new publishing houses, you know, kind of new voices, new authors, you know, kind of new ideas. That was the idea behind this. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to give a platform for these new authors that want to make a name for themselves, but they can't, you know, the traditional route of finding an agent and getting a book published through a big publisher is just, you know, the gatekeepers are just too rigid and too formulaic in the way they look at novels, and it takes forever to break through. You know, you're going to get rejected a ton of times. So that's so I wanted to, you know, this new method of self-publishing on Amazon and on CreateSpace, it kind of created new opportunities. And so I wanted to help authors that chose to go on that kind of entrepreneurial route. Well, And I really had a couple of examples of success stories and really, you know, a real glimpse of what maybe we might be seeing a change in science fiction, kind of a shift into new ideas, new thinking by circumventing the quote-unquote establishment, the big publishers, the major agents. You know, most of these people reside in New York and they've been doing this in a long time and they kind of follow kind of a set pattern or structure to these things. And so there's not really a lot of chance for innovation in writing. And I had some examples. I had Hugh Howey and Wool, The Martian by Andy Weir, A.J. Riddle and The Atlantis Gene. So there were some examples of these really popular big-time books that were either self-published or published through a very small kind of mom-and-pop cottage industry publishing company. And I thought that's maybe might be kind of a new segment of the genre, and that might be where we're going. Well, that was back in about 2012, and now it's we're reaching the end of 2016 here, and it's pretty clear that is not where science fiction is going. I've learned a few things in the last few years about that. Basically, there's really not an interest or a demand in new authors or new voices from independent authors. It seems to me that readers don't really give a shit where the book comes from, whether it's a big publisher or self-published, as long as it's been highly recommended and touted. You know, I kind of used as my model like the indie rock band scene in music. You know, there's these people that love indie music because it's indie, because it's, you know, not corporate. You know, the famous joke is, well, I like, you know, some snobby rock, indie rock, you know, fan is like, well, I like that band until they became popular. You know, they kind of like the fact that they had kind of the inside track on these new voices, these new unique bands that only a few people knew. It was kind of an exclusive club. And these bands could make decent money. Like, they weren't millionaires. They weren't, you know, selling out stadiums. But a lot of them tour all the time and have been at it for years, and they make decent money, and they have a fan base of maybe tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands. It's enough for them to pay their bills and do what they love and do it on their own terms, because they don't need an agent and they don't need big record label backing to do what they do. And there's a lot of record labels out there that kind of support that style of music and that kind of image and that kind of persona. I thought there might be something like that emerging in science fiction, but that just did not happen. Science fiction readers, based on kind of book sales and what I've seen so far in conventions and when I talk to people, is that they don't really care where a movie or book or TV show comes from. As long as it's familiar and highly recommended, and in the end, they'll give it a chance. And so that's, so really, you know, the whole indie approach, indie science fiction, just didn't become a thing. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, I don't really, maybe it doesn't, maybe it just, it was just a miscalculation on my part. You know, the marketplace is pretty satisfied with the products they get. They, you know, maybe not everyone, but I mean, a lot of people fork out a lot of money to go see movies. A lot of people are watching these TV shows I've been talking about. And a lot of, you know, book sales are maybe a little bit low, but they're not, you know, they're not falling apart. And a lot of people are still, you know, buying this stuff. And one thing I noticed about the bestseller list for science fiction is there's a lot of classics on the list. So there's a lot of people that are buying bestsellers from years past, classics, you know, things that have been, that are high profile. And I think that's really where people are, that they go for what's familiar and what they already know is good. I mean, whether it's an author they already know is successful or they've already read their stuff before, if it's a TV show based on something that is based on something else, I mean, we have reboots and prequels and sequels and remakes left and right. And that seems to be what people are consuming. And they, you know, we joke and complain about, you know, this is all that Hollywood and TV gives us. But in the end, we're forking out the money. The marketplace is largely buying this and consuming it at historic levels in a lot of ways. So this big wave didn't happen, and this kind of, you know, didn't happen. So I've decided that, and I also had, I struggled to find independent authors that A, you know, had a very good idea going for them, and B, wanted to talk to me. For A, because it's so easy to self-publish, somebody who just did not do any work to develop their novel can put something out there, and it'll fall flat on its face because it's undeveloped, it's not ready, or maybe it's just really bad. But, you know, they didn't get any beta readers or alpha readers. They didn't get an editor. They didn't think it through. They didn't have any kind of outside voices trying to tell them that, you know, maybe this isn't ready. Maybe you need to work on this a little harder. Or maybe there should have been a gatekeeper to say, no, you shouldn't publish this. It's not going to go anywhere. So when you have kind of a rush of really low quality, undeveloped, unprepared self-published books into the marketplace, you know, it's very easy for people to kind of, you know, say, look, well, I'm not going to start a book that might be terrible. You know, I can't dedicate that kind of time into something that might be a total waste of time. So I'm going to stick to what I know and stick to what's been recommended to me and what sounds, you know, what's familiar. And that's really, unfortunately, what's happened. So as I've gone out there trying to find independent authors and independent books to promote, I just ran into a ton of books that just were not ready. They were undeveloped, and some of them were just terrible. Or they're copies of a famous, you know, kind of like a Me Too of The Hunger Games. So it took me, I found about 8 good ones in the year and a half, in the 3 years, well, how long have I had? I've had Prescient Sci-Fi for 2.5, 3 years, and I only found 8 that I really thought were really good, and then a couple that were okay, and then the other about 30 or 40 I read were mediocre or just really bad, just not, shouldn't have never been published. And I can't spend, I don't have the time to read the amount of books it would take to find each good one, because it seems to be 1 out of every 5 or 1 out of every 6. And I can't bring myself to read 5 or 6, you know, indie books a month and have 4 or 5 of them be terrible. I mean, I just can't do it. And I can frankly see why readers don't really give new authors a chance, because they don't want to spend the time, you know, 1 hour, 2, 3 hours into reading a book and then find out it's awful, and then they stop and they can't get their money back and they can't get that time back. And I also understand why readers will sometimes just read the first 2 chapters and then decide whether or not they want to buy the book, because they don't want to spend any more time on something that could be terrible or could be just wrong for them. So with that in mind, I'm no longer going to promote or spend the time to promote indie science fiction, self-published science fiction. I can't do it. I don't have the time to read all that material and find the good stuff. And frankly, it also, and for, you know, B, the second reason that I'm stopping this is I frankly just found that authors are not, most of them just don't seem all that interested in really promoting their book on a podcast. I ran into another author that I contacted about maybe talking about their book a month ago, tried to schedule a podcast, and they canceled the first time, and then we tried to reschedule, and they said, well, I can't do it for a couple of weeks. So I was like, okay, well, just get back to me when you have some time, and you know, I never heard back from them. So if I have to go through all that trouble just to schedule interviews about somebody else's work, you know, I'm trying to help them. You know, and some of them never got, you know, some authors never got back to me at all. I mean, I think I spoke about this a few months ago. I've tried to contact authors about either an interview or something, you know, on my website, and they never got back to me. And I've been lucky. I mean, a few times I've been able to meet some authors that not only got back to me, but also did the interview and were also very good guests. You know, Retsy Bruno I've had on the show several times, Mark R. Healy, Simon West Bulford. So I've been able to find a few good ones, but I mean, I've had this podcast for almost a year and a half now, and I've only been able to really nail down 3 or 4 author interviews. That's not enough. And it just takes, and if they're just not that interested in promoting their work on a podcast, which maybe they're introverts, maybe they're just not comfortable talking in public, they're public speaking. My other thought is they probably looked up my, you know, traffic and decided, you know, or they never heard of me and they figured, well, if I've never heard of them, you know, then why should I bother? You know, basically thinking that they only want to talk to big time podcasts so they can promote their book. I mean, if that's what their attitude was, I mean, I can, you know, who's to say if that was it, maybe it wasn't, but in any event, I'm not getting a lot of feedback from authors. Some of them are dying for me to read their book, and then I do. And I try to, you know, reach out to them, and they're just nowhere to be found. So forget it. So I'm dropping that. I will read, if somebody has a recommendation and a good reason for me to read a book, indie or self-published, I will give it a chance. But otherwise, I'm not gonna go out hunting for them anymore. I've been doing that for the last year and a half, trying to find these books and these authors, and it's just not working. So I will be So this kind of draws some questions about, well, what the hell are you going to do now if that's not what your focus is going to be? And lately, I've moved Prestate more towards kind of being a commentary on, TV, movies, and some of the more high-profile books of the last year or so. And I think it's going to be more like that, more of just kind of my take and my approach to science fiction, and some commentary and some news, of course, some updates, trying to draw attention to things that maybe some books or maybe some TV shows that you might not be watching, and also just give a little bit more in-depth analysis on some of the elements and pieces of science fiction from my own perspective. I have kind of a very strong background in, certain disciplines professionally that I think a lot of most other blogs don't have, or most other websites do not have. So that's really what I want to bring to Prescient for Thought Crime. I think we're going to do what we're doing. Just no more author interviews. That's that just it's just not doing it for the it's not doing it for you. I've noticed that author interviews really don't do any better in terms of traffic than my other podcasts. So that's over. We're gonna just keep doing the shows we've been doing for the last 6 months, and I'm thinking of maybe changing a few other things up on this show. I haven't really figured out how I'm gonna do it yet. We're all kind of still talking about it. We might, I don't know if we're gonna change the format, but we might change maybe the style a little bit. Might get a new co-host. I am in talks with a few people that are interested in maybe changing direction on this and changing the style of Thought Crime. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not. That's still kind of in the early stage. But anyway, that's where we are. And, there's nothing really wrong with that. It's just, I think it's more on me that I kind of thought that this is science fiction was going to move in a more kind of indie direction, kind of in the way music is, and it just didn't. And I think a lot of authors are now, they wanted to give self-publishing a shot, but, a lot of them, as soon as they get some success, they get an agent and they start publishing the traditional route because they don't want to do all the work anymore. They want to start shifting the workload over to publishers and agents instead. And I can't blame them, I kind of feel that way too, that it would really free up a lot of my time to write more if I didn't have to do all this other stuff, if I had a publisher or an agent. So, and really just science fiction and fantasy, spec fiction in general, it's not really like a unified community of like-minded individuals. It's really more like a collection of fiefdoms, and everyone has like their own fandom within science fiction or within fantasy. And we all kind of share things at conventions, and we all kind of share maybe being a little weird, nerdy, and kind of, some people like to play cosplay. Some of us just come in, but really, the kind of the shared identity and shared culture, it's just not, it doesn't seem to translate into action. I just do not, I haven't found that. I found that everyone has a favorite, whether it's, if you're a Star Wars fan, you're a hardcore Star Wars fan, and the rest of science fiction is kind of like, maybe you have a few other things, but nah, it's more like you're not really a science fiction fan, you're a Star Wars fan, and you just kind of like, the rest of science fiction is okay. So I think very few people really adopt science fiction as a whole or adopt fantasy as a whole. They usually pick one or two things, and then the rest of it they can do without. They don't really give it really a shot. Some people are more like Renaissance people. They love all things science fiction, but I found like they're more of the exception than the rule. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing right or wrong about any of this. This is all entertainment. This is all just us having fun. Anyway, so that's my little spiel on some of the changes that you might be seeing at prescientsci-fi.com and also here at Thought Crime. But I will wrap up this episode number 42 there. Just to sum up, I do recommend Arrival for people who like thought-provoking and kind of cerebral science fiction movies. It's not the greatest movie of all time. It's not really like a award. I don't know if it's going to win any awards or anything, but I think it is very smart and well done, and I do recommend it for that. I do recommend Stranger Things for just about everyone. I think it's a cool show. I don't personally, there's some things about it that I'm not too crazy about, but I think overall it's a really cool show, and I do recommend it. Westworld, of course, I still recommend. So those are the three things I talked about today. I'm going to start Black Mirror in the next week or two, and maybe talk about that a little bit. I know I'm way behind on that. Black Mirror, I think, has been around for a while, And also the show Incorporated begins on Sci-Fi Channel here on November 30th, the same day that Vikings, the new season of Vikings, starts. I fucking love Vikings. In fact, if Westworld was real, I would tell those people, you know what? The Wild West is nice, but you really should make a Viking world. Make a, you know, with robots, Vikings, you get to relive your fantasies of being marauders across the sea. I mean, come on. That's, to me, that's what I want to do. So, how about it, science? Get on that. But I will leave it there. That'll do it for this episode of Thought Crime. Until next time.